All right, well, I don't know whether anyone else is going to come at this stage. So let's head on into the wind. The issue of the relationship between apologetics and evangelism has been a recurring theme for me, and I've been on no end of evangelism training conferences, which have left me feeling deeply dissatisfied. And I've heard some people talking about apologetics in a way that I can't quite lock that into the wider picture. And then I was particularly provoked a couple of years ago, the first of these conferences, when we had a track doing evangelism at the same time as the track doing apologetics. And I was wondering throughout that week, you know, what are they talking about? And what is significantly different about their how they see their task and how we see their task? It perplexed me quite a lot. So I've been driven back again and again to look at the New Testament text to see what the apostles were actually doing, to see if I can, for my own evangelistic work, that I'm trying to do what I should be doing and not getting crushed into a style that isn't appropriate. I'll just get my New Testament. So we're going to start by looking at some of the things that were going on in the New Testament, then we'll draw out some of the implications of that. And then we will go on from there. I need to say at the outset, I don't have any knowledge of Greek. I made a constant reference to Greek words because I feel to get into this dilemma, you need to actually get back and see, well, what do these words actually mean if we're to be able to move with them and get a feeling to fill out the picture as to what was going on and not just be fobbed off with a word which actually might be misleading. And there certainly are one or two words that I think don't lead us into it without a second and closer look. So I'd like to start at Thessalonica, which I found a helpful passage because we have a little cluster of words there that fill out the picture quite well. And we learn there in verse 3 of Thessalonica that Luke says that Paul, what he was doing here was proclaiming Christ. And it seems to me in evangelism that's what we need to be doing, proclaiming Christ. So this is Paul proclaiming Christ. And now we need to look and see what he's doing. And the second thing that's really helpful about this is in verse 2, where he says, as his custom was. So it's outwardly stated that this is Paul's normal practice. This isn't an aberration. This isn't under particularly difficult circumstances in Thessalonica he behaved in an odd way. This was just routine evangelism for Paul. And this collection of words, I think, is all the more enlightening because of that context. And the first verb then that we get in verse 2 is that he reasoned with them. At least most versions seem to translate it in English as reasoned, which rather implies some sort of hard-line logical process that was going on. But actually, the Greek word is an interesting one. I don't know how it should be pronounced, dialegomai, it would seem to be. Dia meaning across or through, and lego to say. And the Vine's Dictionary of New Testament Words, which I go back to again and again to try and understand any of these things, defines it in these terms. To think different things with oneself, to resolve in one's mind, to ponder, and then with other persons. To converse, to argue, to dispute, to reason, and to discuss. Literally to dialogue. But not by way of a sermon, but by way of a discourse of a more conversational character. And this is a common word that's used to describe Paul in action. So we get it here at Thessalonica, but we get it at Athens, and we get it at Corinth, and we get it at Ephesus, and we have it at Troas, and we have it in Caesarea. So we very much do get the impression that dialogue was his normal way of doing it, as his custom was. This was the normal thing, that when Paul had an opportunity to talk about the gospel, he instinctively was engaging in dialogue. And we need that corrective, particularly when we look at Acts 17, which we see as such a model for apologetic work, which itself was a monologue. Paul's normal thing was in the interaction, immediate interaction with the people that he was meeting. And the next word there in verse 3 is that he was explaining the gospel. The Greek word I understand is dianoigo, which means to open up. Somebody put it memorably by saying that it's not what we say that matters, it's what they hear. And the only way we can assess what people are hearing, what they're taking on board, is actually in dialogue. You've got to get some feedback. So I could talk to you, you know, for any length of time, and only find out at the end that none of you speak English. I mean, I'm not to know that. You know, I could pick up whether you might smile a joke or something, but otherwise, you know, I'm not going to get any understanding of whether you understand what I'm batting on about. So there has got to be this feedback. And we have got some explaining to do. The gospel isn't altogether clear and straightforward, however much you try and reduce it to its simplest essence. There are concepts which for some people in some cultural contexts find enormously strange, as they did in Athens. What are these strange things you're saying? There's a lot of explaining to do. As a medical doctor, one of the things I found very difficult to understand as a medical student was the larynx, the voice box. It's anatomically actually very complicated. And I read books on the stuff and I went to the lectures and I just hadn't got it, you know. But eventually I had a tutorial from, well, somebody tipped me off and said that you want to go to that anatomist and ask her to explain it to you. She's brilliant. And she somehow got me inside the larynx and I could see the muscles going here and going there and how the vocal cords pulled. And you know, and she was able to hear my difficulties and why I couldn't understand it. And at the end of it, I came away with understanding. So that sort of interaction is essential for explaining, and explaining is essential for our task. We've got a lot of explaining to do, and dialogue. Well, this is why we make students sit exams, isn't it? Because otherwise, if they don't sit exams, we haven't a clue whether they've learned anything. And dialogue is a way of just monitoring as you're going along. So you might be using language, you might be using jargon that they can't understand, you might be pitching it at an intellectual level that they can't find. You quickly find your level in dialogue. So if you're dialoguing with children, you're going to, you know, be expressing yourself in a totally different way than if you're talking to professors or people from particular cultures. So you are constantly adjusting the tuning until you're at a level where they can grasp what you're saying. And the next verb then is that Paul was proving that Christ had to suffer and rise. The word there, paratithemai, to place beside, to put near, or to commend. And probably in this context, it refers to Paul showing that the scriptures have been fulfilled in history. He's putting the events that had taken place alongside the scriptures, and therefore persuading them that this is that, what the prophets who had been going on about, now has taken place. And of course, if we're to try and argue persuasively, again, dialogue is essential for that. Unless they are voicing their doubts and showing that, no, I'm not persuaded about that, you haven't made the case out at all properly. You're driven back to sort of work harder, to state the case again, to clarify what the particular intellectual difficulty is the person's having, why he finds the argument weak, and you can then strengthen it. So dialogue then is essential in explaining proving, to use the word that Luke uses here. And the end result of all this in the next verse is that some Jews and many Greeks, including some prominent women, were persuaded. And the word there is pytho, to prevail upon, to win over, to persuade, to bring about a change of mind by the influence of reason or moral considerations. So it isn't just a simple or a straight line logical progression, as you know, 2 + 2 = 4. They are coming to a conviction of mind, which all sorts of factors might well be involved in them being persuaded. It isn't, as far as I can see, a simplistic process. And so the implication is that their doubts and difficulties, their moral and intellectual objections to the gospel were addressed convincingly. And in the context of dialogue, there is that possibility. So all this is what Paul was doing in proclaiming the gospel, reasoning, explaining, proving, and persuading. This was his normal practice before he ever got to Athens. So we've had a lot about Athens this week, and rightly so. But these are what was going on anyway. So when Paul gets to Athens, we read in verse 17 that he reasoned in the synagogue. That's the word dialogue again. He dialogued in the synagogue. I mean, clearly their synagogues are very different from our churches. They obviously fully expected people to come in and to make contributions. It wouldn't even tie in with a brethren assembly, but it certainly expects people to contribute. And there clearly was that exchange in the synagogue with the Jews and with the Greeks, as well as in the marketplace. And he did this day by day with whoever happened to be there. The philosophers engaged with this because they presumably saw in his style something they could identify with. Here was somebody who was asking them questions back, that was exploring ideas together, that he wasn't just haranguing them, but he was pushing them about what they believed and throwing the questions back at him. And they probably saw something of the Socratic method in what he was doing, and certainly felt that the sheer content and importance of what he was saying justified an invitation to addressing the Council of the Areopagus. And of course, well, we had a lot on this whole passage, so I'll not go into that at great length. But when Paul was dialoguing with the Jews in the synagogue, the repeated reference to from the scriptures that he was, you know, there was the common ground. Paul was a Jew and they were Jews, and the scriptures were the common ground, so the dialogue all focused around the scriptures. But now he's with pagan Greeks, so he can't get his Bible out there. They would be completely lost as to what this document was. So he goes in on their territory. Observes their religious beliefs, the objects of their worship, their thinking about temples, and of course, in detail, he engages with their position. Did you see? Did everyone get this paper from Bruce Winter on introducing the Athenians to God? Did you see that one?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
Because of right, because that's. Yeah, that looks at it in some depth.
Yeah.
Have a look at that. Sorry, because I think that's a paper well worth. That's one of the best papers I've read on the subject. It's a detailed assessment, but I'm not sure that it was written for any particular seminar. It just was written as a sort of background paper for the conference. Well, I'm not. I thought probably it had been sent to everyone, but whether. She should be able to send it to you. Yeah, so make a note of the title of it. Right. Okay. But it's well worth reading. I thought it was a detailed study of what he was doing there, how he confronts their philosophies and identifies with one group of philosophers over another, and he quotes their poets and. Aratus of Cilicia and Epimenides of Crete. He lays into their idolatry and goes on to present Christ as the Lord who is calling them to account. And Luke sets this passage out in considerable detail, short and compressed as it is a classic presentation of the gospel to a pagan culture. So he was dialoguing. Even though this was a monologue, it was effectively a dialogue. He had studied where they were at, he had read what they were saying, he had listened to them in the marketplace, and it was in the light of all that that when he does get an opportunity to give a monologue, it is a very dialogical monologue, very much engaged with where they're at. It is the only detailed account of Paul addressing pagans. The other glimpse we get is Paul with the farmers at Lystra in Acts 14. And there he doesn't speak about their philosophy and he doesn't speak about the scriptures, but he talks there about their world and the things they're familiar with. He talks about God's kindness in giving rain from heaven and crops in their season and plenty of food and being provided from the earth and filling our hearts with joy. So it's just the instinctive way he comes in at where people are, to taking on board their position. So he then moves on to Corinth, and I'll come back and comment on this in a few minutes about this, how many people feel that he adopted a different approach at Corinth, an anti-intellectual, simplistic approach, where he just talked about the cross. And some people have said that this is to be in contradistinction from the way he did it at Athens, but that isn't the distinction that he's making at all. And from what we see here in chapter 18, verse 4, that he was back into the synagogue, dialoguing, reasoning with them, trying to persuade Jews and Greeks. And the real distinction was that he wasn't providing them with the rhetorical flourishes and the fine words and the whole style of public oratory that they were expecting. His time in Corinth was prolonged. It wasn't just a sort of a fleeting visit. He was there for 18 months, verse 11 tells us. And his work there was summed up by the Jews, who then took him to the proconsul Gallio, and said, "This man is persuading the people to worship God in ways that are contrary to the law." So they saw persuasion as being central to what he was trying to do. He wasn't just simply stating a message about a crucified Savior. He was persuading them that it was true. And in fact, one of the best, most succinct statements of Paul about what he was doing was in his second letter to the Corinthians, where he wrote that since we know what it is to fear the Lord, we try to persuade men. So whether it's in Athens or Thessalonica or in Corinth or wherever, this business of persuasion in the context of dialogue seems to be central. So he moves on to Ephesus, and we have a similar story there where he's in dialogue with the Jews in verse 19. And then for 3 months he spoke boldly in the synagogue. And then we have this phrase, arguing persuasively about the kingdom of God. And I thought about this evangelism track in this conference 2 years ago. I just wonder how many of the people there would have described what they were doing in evangelism. How many evangelists we see at large and that we know and engage would actually use that phrase to describe what they were doing. You gave an evangelistic address tonight, did you? Were you arguing persuasively about the kingdom of God? And I think a great many would recoil from that and they'd say, no, it's not at all what I was doing. I was simply proclaiming the cross and not pandering to their intellects. And then at Ephesus, he moves on to this lecture school in Tyrannus, where for 2 years he held daily discussions. It's a fascinating picture there. And the whole position of Ephesus in Asia Minor meant that everyone going anywhere came through Ephesus. And so we can read that all the Greeks and Jews in the province of Asia Minor heard the gospel. And in these three statements there about Paul in Ephesus, this word dialegomai, dialogue, is used. When he goes on to meet with Festus and Agrippa, Paul's accused famously of being out of his mind, and he responded that he wasn't insane, that what he was saying is true and reasonable. The king's familiar with these things. I'm convinced that none of this has escaped his notice because it has not been done in a corner. In other words, he's saying the evidence is on the table. You know, the king knows what the facts of the matter are. And Agrippa replied, "Do you think in such a short time you can persuade me to be a Christian?" So it's quite clear to Agrippa that what was going on too, that he was knocking out the ground from under him, bringing powerful arguments to bear, and trying to persuade him to become a Christian. And then the final picture we have of Paul in Rome, that he is under house arrest. The dialogue continues. The visitors flock in to see him, and from morning to evening, this is chapter 28:23. From morning to evening, he explained and declared to them the kingdom of God, trying to convince the Jews about Jesus from the law and the prophets. And some, we're told, were convinced. So all these words seem to affirm the same basic picture. And because it isn't just Paul, the classic picture of Philip and the Ethiopian eunuch. Do you understand what you're reading? How can I, unless someone explains it to me? And so he climbs up into the chariot and he sits next to him. And together they discuss the passage. So there's the dialogue. Philip's asking the questions and then having to do the explaining. And the word persuasion doesn't come into the passage, but we can easily see that that's what the end result was. He became convinced that these things were true. Apollos. There's another interesting example. We're told that he was a learned man with a thorough knowledge of the scriptures, Acts 18:24. He was well equipped to engage with the Jews, and we're told that he vigorously refuted the Jews in public debate, proving from the scriptures that Jesus was the Christ. And as we look at these people in the book of Acts, we shouldn't lose sight of the way Christ himself proclaimed the kingdom of God. He was constantly asking his hearers questions. And they would come with one question and he would reply with another. So the expert lawyer, "What must I do to inherit eternal life?" And he said, "Well, what's written in the law? How do you read it?" And he spells out the first and second commandment. You should love your neighbor as yourself. And so he decides he will test Jesus. "Well, who then is my neighbor?" And Jesus tells the famous parable of the Good Samaritan. He says, "Well, which of these three do you think was the neighbor?" And he puts the question back to him. So Jesus is doing the same sort of Socratic questioning and dialogue, helping them to think through the issues with him as to what was going on. Now, I think we had this interesting session this morning looking with David Cook about why there is so little interest in apologetics in the church at large. And I'm sure this misunderstanding about what happened at Corinth has got a lot to do with it. We read in 1 Corinthians 2 that is used. 1 Corinthians 2:1. "When I came to you, brothers, I did not come with eloquence or superior wisdom as I proclaimed to you the testimony about God. For I resolved to know nothing while I was with you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. I came to you in weakness, in fear, and in much trembling. My message and my preaching were not with wise and persuasive words, but with a demonstration of the Spirit's power, so that your faith might not rest in men's wisdom or the power of God." And I think we can easily understand from that why this confusion has arisen. And so that the view has been that he had a totally different approach. He had such a poor response at Athens, that's what they say, that only two or three people seemed to respond, that he gave up that approach and he was driven back to basics. But that understanding begs enormous questions. And I think we need to identify these factors and argue them in the wider Christian community. Because it means that this address of Paul at Athens that Luke has recorded in such detail was actually recorded as an example of how not to do evangelism. on that basis. You know, Paul gave up on that. He found a better way of doing it. And yet Luke records in detail an example of how not to do it. And silly old Luke, he then forgot to say that this is an example of how not to do it. So there's nothing in the text that makes us think that he regretted it. We can only, and since we don't have another account of Paul addressing pagans, it's inconceivable that this was written down other than as a model for us to follow. And the book of Acts gives us no grounds for thinking that he changed his style when he went to Corinth, as we've just looked at in verse 4. Every Sabbath he reasoned in the synagogue, trying to persuade the Jews and the Greeks. Well, that's exactly what he had been doing all along. So his proclamation in Corinth followed just the same pattern at Athens. And that continued, as we've just seen, when he went on to Ephesus. So 1 Corinthians 2:1 must be understood in these terms. He didn't do anything differently. He merely dissociated himself from the expectations of the Corinthians, who clearly had a particular style of oratory and sophisticated rhetoric from public speakers that he really was not interested. He wasn't going to play ball with that. And Bruce Winter's paper, Introducing the Athenians to God, Paul's Failed Apologetic in Acts 17, unpacks that very clearly. Now, dialogue is not the same as alternating monologues. I've heard people doing a sort of dialogue in evangelism, but they're not actually listening to what the other person's saying. They're almost taking it in turns to speak. So one person sort of rattles on and, have you finished? Right, now I'll tell you what I want you to hear. And so he then tells them the other fellow's looking out the window, then he's not interested in that. Why don't you shut up? Now I'll tell you, But the whole thing about this dialogue is there's an engagement with minds. This is a careful listening and working on things together, a resolving of issues, a two-way traffic of ideas. It can be confrontational, but it need not be. In a dialogue, we sit next to the unbeliever, and the confrontation is with the gospel that stands outside both of us, and we encourage him to, or her to, engage with it. Authentic Christian dialogue has been massively obscured in contemporary Christian mind by so-called interfaith ecumenical dialogues. And these dialogues have really given dialogue as a concept a very bad name and reputation. So when you mention dialogue to people, they're likely, certainly in my part of the world, to think in terms of these dialogues, which are not concerned to win over the other side at all. In fact, it's a ground rule that you don't try and persuade someone else. The whole purpose of the dialogue is that you understand each other. It's an exercise in empathy. It's a mutual informing. But to actually deconstruct what they're saying is completely out of order. And some people can be quite dogmatic about this. There's a book, I was going to say an interesting book, I didn't actually find it an interesting book. There's a book called Death or Dialogue by liberal scholars Paul Nitter and Leonard Swidler. And this is their view of dialogue. And so anyone who has absolute claims about what he's saying, who believes what he is saying is true, in a way that someone else who has a different belief is believing something that's untrue, they're not even allowed in the room. You can't come in unless you're a relativist. And it's quite interesting how, relativists have a capacity to stab themselves in the back with self-refuting statements. So Nitter concedes in that book that by excluding all those who make absolute claims from the dialogue, he's made an absolute out of relativism. But it's all a far cry from what the apostles were doing. So we need to reclaim dialogue as an entirely proper normative way of sharing the faith and engaging with people that is very different from this sort of interfaith, relativistic, ecumenical dialogue.
Wasn't it, I don't know when, maybe it was at the time of the Reformation, but being ecumenical by definition, actually meant that. It actually meant not on, there was a unity of faith, but there was a rigor of debate in that. So that was part and parcel of being ecumenical, was actually to root the debate views.
Right.
And to do it in the context of our unity in Christ.
Yes.
Which is slightly different now, but actually that's now taboo, isn't it, is to root the debate.
Well, of course, in a pluralistic society, we're not. The doors are widened to anyone, to the household of faith. And I've heard people, even on the board of the Church of England's Board of Mission, talking about the people of faith to include. In fact, I had a challenge about this, but they were talking about the Hindus and the Buddhists. And I said, well, hold on, why are you just stopping at the major faiths? Surely, if we're talking about faith in that sense. My understanding of it is there was something like 800 new religions started in the last century, you know. Are they all welcome? You know, it doesn't matter what you believe. And surely, you know, humanists, are they not making a faith statement about the existence or not of God? So anyone who operates... Yeah, it's such a complete misuse of the word faith, isn't it? And so everyone's included in this sort of thing, and you sit down with anyone who believes anything about anything, and you can talk to them as long as you don't try and persuade them out of it. Yeah, which is a very different sort of world from the great ecumenical conferences which pulled diverse Christians together to see, to try and arrive at things that they were all mutually persuaded about. Yeah. Bruce's paper gives us the essential, what he sees as the essential authentic Christian, essential features of authentic Christian dialogue. I just wish, I spent 10 years on the Board of Mission, and dialogue was so completely seen in this sort of interfaith thing, that having tried to challenge it, and I was just completely poo-pooed, you know, I mean, it's ridiculous to think that you're trying... People are coming with absolutes and try and persuade people, you know, they weren't going to have anything to do with that. And it's very difficult to then sort of get up and say about it. But I just, you know, I just wish I'd thought a little bit more about it and wittered on with rather more vigour about the thing, because their position is untenable. And what Bruce says here about dialogue in the New Testament is, I think, very clear and very important, that you're connecting with your hearers, you're correcting their misconceptions, you're conversing, engaging with their ideological framework, you're convicting them of, as he puts it, of compromises with their consciences. You know, people don't live as they, you know, they say, well, I'm such a good person. A number of people have told me over the years what a good person they are, you know. We've got a proper role in undermining that one and bringing conviction that they're not half as good as they are saying they are. And confronting them with the coming judgment. So there are a number of features succinctly listed there as to what we should be doing. So what does this teach us then about evangelism? Well, it seems clear that Paul did not see the task of proclaiming the gospel in simplistic terms. He engaged with people's views, and thereby their cultural assumptions and beliefs, they were all essential to the task. He heard what they were saying, refuted their objections. The study was the preparation for the task. Dialogue was the method he engaged, and persuasion was the intention that he was going for. And I think, in contrast with what many people would say about evangelism, that they would see study of the person's culture not at all part of the evangelist's task. Dialogue that they would see as quite irrelevant. You just stand on the soapbox in the marketplace, and you know, I'm sure Paul would never have used a soapbox in the marketplace. He was, you know, he was on their level. He was alongside them. He was engaging with them, and persuasion is where he wanted to go. It's all a far cry. So where does that leave us? If that is what evangelism is, what then is apologetics? Well, I think there are two broad views about apologetics today, and they both seem, to, in my view, to fall a long way short from this picture that we've been looking at. And the first view is that all that we're called to do is to teach and preach about Jesus, and people's questions and objections and difficulties are of no account to us. That's between them and God. God must bring the conviction. and such things should be regarded as red herrings. To even to engage with them is to play the devil at his own game. If the Lord doesn't bring conviction, then there's nothing more we can do. So we preach the gospel and we go home and we pray for them. The second view is that apologetics is very helpful for some, particularly academic people, intellectual people, people of particular disciplines who have particular problems with their field of study. The task of the apologist is to address those issues and clear away the hindrances so that they can then hear the gospel presented in simple, straightforward terms. And I think, actually, although I haven't talked to him personally about that, but from what he's written and from what he's said, I think Bill Craig would probably take that view. But I'm not happy with that. I don't think it really does justice to the picture that we've looked at. The Greek word apologia does occur in the New Testament, but it's not often with reference to the gospel. It's usually with reference to people defending themselves against their accusers. So when they're hauled up before the magistrates, they give an apologia. Or when the mob's got them, they justify what they're doing, or so forth. There are a few references, and of course the classic one is 1 Peter 3:15, that we should be ready always to give a reason for the hope that's within us, and this word apologia comes there. And that seems to be a fairly general statement about our witness. It's not something that's reserved for special occasions. It's something all of us need to be engaged in to defend. And the passage in Philippians chapter 1, which talks about this, it talks about the defense and the confirmation of the gospel. So if the defending of the gospel is sort of, in cricketing terms, playing off your back foot a defensive shot, you know, the commenting is a much more sort of a forward drive, a much more aggressive isn't the right word, but a more intentional strike. And I think we should note that there's no one in the New Testament who's described as being an apologist. It isn't listed as a gift. It just isn't a category that the Bible uses. And so I think we do need to be careful. Again, one of Bruce's seminars this week, he was talking about the Trojan horse of carrying in a word or a concept into the Christian discussion, which actually isn't a Bible word. We just need to have our alarm bells ringing and say, well, hold on, is this actually a Bible concept? So it seems to me that we shouldn't set people apart as being apologists, and we shouldn't set them apart as being evangelists either.
Why do you say the latter thing?
Well, that evangelists, anyone who's doing evangelism is doing apologetics. That it is integral to the task. It's not a separate entity. So yes, sure, there are evangelists, but evangelists must be seen in this wider context. So the term apologetics has some usefulness in describing a body of knowledge which has accumulated and can be resourced and tapped into in order to help us defend the gospel. But the popular use, I think, does confuse the issues. And many people just see evangelism as the more spiritual thing, and they think that it's pandering to people's sinfulness to deal with their questions.
One of the reasons why there is a general practice, there is this distinction, is that sometimes you can be talking to somebody and simply not successfully communicate to them, and so you haven't really engaged. You've tried your best to engage them, but you haven't actually managed. So you kind of justify that by saying, well, you know, who said something, we must have picked up something.
Yeah.
And so... what you're saying is dangerous, that we then make that all that there is to do, and we say, because it's hard to actually engage people, we just stop at that level.
Yeah.
Because sometimes that's the way it turns out.
Yeah.
We try our best to engage, but all we end up doing is saying a few things.
Yeah.
So we can pat ourselves on the head.
Yeah. And it's the soft option then to walk away from it.
And then in the future, you say, well, if that time that was all I could do, the next time that's all I will do.
Yes.
So it's easier to stop that.
Yeah.
Can I say something? Because it does seem, certainly in our church context, that we are, that the majority of people who are coming in and talking about Christ and share the gospel with are people who are uncommonists, of course, and are usually fringy type, and people who are perhaps more interested in us than coming. But the mass of people out there are a million miles away.
Yeah.
We don't engage them at all.
Yeah.
We never win an ear with them.
Yeah.
And I think it's just a reflection, but I have a sense that we're intimidated intellectually.
Yeah.
We think we lost the intellectual battle. We're too nervous to go and actually tackle it.
I think the other thing that happens, possibly, is that, I don't know, St. James Russell Garvey, but because there are some large, thriving, successful churches in certain city centres, we've got actually their work cut out to deal with the fringe who are coming.
Yeah.
It's such a good place to come for the fringe.
Yeah.
That there isn't the appetite to go out to where people who wouldn't ordinarily give an
ear.
Yeah. But the kind of people who are coming into the fringe are people who've got some kind of religious conviction. Which means it doesn't mean they've got a wrong mindset, but it.
They've got a relative who's been converted, or they've got something, haven't they? Yeah.
They're not your kind of out and out person.
No.
Who just would never come in and who would just quite. Sense that they're not engaging those people.
And when we are with these other people, we don't know what to say to them. And I think one of the things that we fail to do, because we've lost this view of dialogue, we don't think to go and ask them questions. And, you know, we could spend the whole time very profitably just asking questions and pushing them. I mean, this was Schaefer's great line. You expose their basic assumptions and get them to talk about where they're at, and then you push them along. And you can do that entirely by questions. Well, why do you say that? And what does that mean in this area? And what happens there? And what does that mean about something else? And you get onto the stage where they're more and more uncomfortable with where they are, and you're deconstructing their position. He talks about that dramatic stage where the lid is taken off. I remember doing this with a guy many years ago who professed to be a communist. And we talked to him about 2 a.m. And I was just asking him questions. I just realized he wasn't going to hear anything I was saying. It was just hopeless. He was just miles away. So I just asked him questions. Go on, tell me about yourself. Where are you from? What's your background? What do you believe? And you're a communist. That's very interesting. Go on, tell me. What does communism mean for you? And we went on and on like that. And then I started trying to sort of narrow it down. Hold on, what is this? And he was a medic. So, you know, what would this mean in ethical terms? And the rights of the community over the individual, and what would that do for euthanasia and all this sort of thing. And I really started to push him on these things, and closing in and asking some personal questions about euthanasia and how he would relate to his parents in that situation, and he became increasingly uncomfortable. And when he left at 2 a.m, he said, "I'll see you tomorrow if I don't jump out of the window beforehand." I mean, that's just what Schaefer talks about. If somebody is in a secure world of beliefs and you just completely deconstruct it, they could do anything, really, depending on how seriously they held their position. But, I mean, you know, he didn't jump out of the window, and I don't think I was seriously worried that he would, but he said it seriously. He obviously felt very uncomfortable at that stage. He'd come in with a fairly contented view of the world, and I just invited him for a coffee. And 4 hours later, he left not able to make sense of his own worldview. Certainly hadn't asked me what my worldview was, although he did know I was a Christian, but he didn't come back on that. So I think we lose a lot by losing this whole view of what is the normative way of going about doing things. And the picture in the New Testament is then that the Holy Spirit's the Spirit of truth, and it is in that muddled world of dialogue and the flow of ideas that the Spirit brings conviction we can't possibly bring. We don't know the things that are going to bring a person to a point of persuasion. And it isn't just a straightforward logical thing. You're presenting evidence, you're presenting the case clearly, you're asking questions of their beliefs. is first in Jude chapter 3, which talks about contending earnestly for the faith. It gives something of the struggle that's involved there that we're called to be engaged in. And, you know, I think a lot of evangelism doesn't seem to involve any struggle at all. So let's move on then. Getting near some conclusions. The scope of apologetics. The very nature of the gospel raises certain questions. Some people have suggested that the agenda's changed. People ask different questions nowadays. But the point here I'm making is that the questions actually flow out of the gospel, not out of the culture. Obviously, there are culturally related questions. But if they've heard the gospel, that itself provokes certain inevitable questions. So whilst there might be much discussion about diverse cultural aspects, once the gospel is clearly on the table, it itself provokes, I put it down as seven, I think Paul Little in his book put down as seven questions, seven deadly questions. I chalk it up against as against the seven deadly sins. But they're very clear, they're very commonly heard, and they just about cover the whole scope of what's going on. Is Christianity the only way to God? Is the Bible reliable? How can miracles be possible? Isn't Christian experience only psychological? Those four are all questions about truth, the truth claims of the gospel. The first one, the uniqueness of Christ in the world's religions. The second one, the reliability of the data we have about Christ. The third one about miracles, which is the whole world of faith and science, and that obviously can come up in a number of guises, but that's basically what that whole area of discourse is going to be about. Hasn't science disproved it all, and that sort of approach? And the question about isn't it only psychological is a discussion about the nature of truth and indeed the nature of faith, which I think we constantly need to go back to and say things clearly about what faith is and what faith isn't. The next two questions, what happens to those who've never heard the gospel and why does God allow suffering, are really inevitable implications of the gospel. If that is true, then hold on, what does it say first about the justice of God and second about the love of God? And the last question about, surely if I'm a good person I go to heaven, well, that's a question about the moral character of God, his holiness. So all these questions break down into questions of truth, questions of the implications of it being true, and then questions about whether this is something I need to be involved in. Does it actually relate to me? And these categories, you know, they're with any purchase. If you're buying a home or you're buying a refrigerator or a car or anything, you're going to ask questions. You know, they say, well, this car does this, that, and the other. Well, does it actually do that many miles to the gallon? Or am I just kidding me there? I mean, if you want to know the details about those sort of questions, how much is it going to cost to service it? All those sort of questions. What are the implications of having it? You know, will it fit in the garage? And then, you know, finally, well, do I actually want it? I've got two cars already. I want a third one for? Oh, well, that's a useless discussion. So, I mean, there's nothing to be surprised about those questions. They're questions that flow out of the product in the context of that sort of language, and are very predictable. So just to give a few conclusions then from this consideration of argument in evangelism. Dialogue enables us to pitch our presentation of the gospel at an intellectual level, a cultural level, at a linguistic level, at a conceptual level that the person can understand. You constantly, it's like adjusting the tuning of the machine. You just crank it up or down till you eventually find the level that is required for good communication, and you've got to be hearing what they're saying. You've got to be getting the feedback to be able to do that. And the questions that are asked as they flow out of the gospel, they're going to be asked by anyone. They're the same, the professor and the most simple person will both say, why does God allow suffering? It's, you know, there's nothing that is germane to the gospel, not germane to the intelligence of the person that you're talking to. And a child will ask the same question. So we have to tune in to where they're at when and give answers that are appropriate. There's no point in giving a sort of PhD level answer to a child or a childish answer to somebody who's asking PhD sort of questions. But it is only in the context of dialogue that we can make that fine tuning. The second conclusion to my mind is that we can identify what those questions are, and that's terribly important for the preparation for the evangelistic task. I had the extraordinary experience when I did my A-level zoology, as we were able to do A-level zoology in my day. There were three groups in the year, and we had three different teachers, and when it came to the practical, as we approached it, we sat having coffee one day with a couple from each of the other 2 years, and we said, hold on, our lecturers are going to, the practical takes place here, therefore they must be told what the exam is. They must know what animals they've got to gas for us to dissect. They've got to set the whole thing up. They have to know in advance what it is we're being asked for this exam. And because they're human, they are bound to give away clues. So if the earthworm doesn't come into it and we keep asking questions about the earthworm, they're going to steer us away from it. They must do. Oh, sir, can we go over the earthworm? And yet again, he's going to sort of, you know. And so we both, the three of us, decided we would take notes. And over the next month, and the sort of run-up to the exam, we were jotting things down. We would do that sort of thing to test him. He said, sir, rabbit's nervous system, sir, can we? And he sort of get his response. Oh, we did that a month or so ago. I don't think we need to. And so I jot that down. And the day before the exam, I tell no lie, there's no exaggeration of this. This is the day before the exam. He said, well, what do you think you're going to get tomorrow? And we were all in our separate groups. I just was in my group. And I hadn't shared this discussion with others in my group. They said, oh, we're going to get the frog, sir. We're going to, the skeletal system of the frog. Right, what do you think we're going to get? It obviously wasn't. It doesn't rise to that. And then he looked sadder and sadder the more it went on. There were seven questions in the exam, and one of them was a dissection, and one of them was an embryology slide. I forget what all the different parts of it were. He said, well, go on, what's the embryology slide you're going to get? Oh, that's going to be the nervous system of the chick. What do you think it's going to be, And so it all carried on like this, with him looking sadder and sadder. And then he saw me, I was just watching this with amusement. And he said, well, you're unusually quiet, mate. What do you think we're going to get? And so suddenly a pause came over the rest of the class, about 20 people, and they were all suddenly quiet. I said, well, I think we're going to start off with the embryology slide, and it's going to be the whatever of the chick. And then we're going to have a spot slide on, and I think it's going to be that. And then we're going to do this, and then we're going to do that, and we're going to finish off with the dogfish dissecting the nervous system. Well, I'd taken out his middle stump. It was obvious I had. He just looked aghast. And so everyone else in the class said, hey, May, can you tell me that again? What's that? So I told them what the embryology was, and they all wrote it all down. And it was exactly as I predicted the next day, and the entire class got distinction for their zoology practical. Well, it was funny. I wasn't embarrassed. I mean, it could have been embarrassing. I mean, his jaw just dropped as he realized that I'd... And he said, why do you think that? What makes you feel that's going to happen? So I told him, I said, I wanted to be quite open. There's no cheating going on here. I've just noted the way that, some things have kept coming up and some things haven't. And furthermore, I've been in discussion with people in other years who've done the same exercise. And we met yesterday and discussed it. And this is what we all felt exactly the same about this. So it was, middle stump job. But the point is that everyone got a distinction. You see, I mean, if you know the questions in advance, it's absolute madness to go into an exam without having worked on it. And because they are predictable, these things, we can obviously work on them ourselves, but there's a whole agenda there that we've got to work at. But there's an agenda there for our churches and for the Christian world at large. These are the questions that are going to come up, and to not bring these fundamental themes into our teaching in the churches is a great folly. So it's not only a help for us in our preparation, but I think also it should influence our preaching. So whenever I'm preaching, whatever the passage is that I'm given to tackle, I always look at it and say, is there one of the seven here? Is there one of the key issues? Is there something that I can quite legitimately sort of flag up here? It might be a reliability of the text. It might be a pluralistic thing. It may mark out the distinctions here between Islam and Hinduism. Is there something in this field of apologetics that I can flag up? And I'm thinking the whole time, you know, is there a non-Christian there in that room? Okay, it's church, it's normal Sunday service, but I'm assuming there are doubters and there are unbelievers there. As I was moved by John Chapman, the Australian evangelist line, he said that he always looks around the room for the most pagan-looking guy. And he says he's usually dreadfully ugly and he's got long sideburns and a downturn moustache. And once I've identified him, I fix him in my gaze and I go for him, and I'm going for him for the lick of my life. Everything I say is pitched to that man. I usually find out afterwards that he's the archdeacon. But, you know, the principles there that you're finding, you're pitching it. And it doesn't need pitching it to non-Christians, and making sure that what you're saying is clear to them and powerful to them shouldn't in any sense be of less interest to Christian people. And rather, they will be, if they're taking notes, they're going to learn ways that they also can engage with these subjects down the track. So, but we just got to seize every opportunity to keep flogging these things. The fourth implication, to my mind, is that that peer group evangelism has to be the normative thing. Well, we're told that Paul said the Jews, he became a Jew for the Jews and a Greek for the Greeks, and we need to follow that right down the line. Undergraduates are the natural people to reach undergraduates. Sportsmen are much better at reaching sportsmen than other people. The lawyers reach the lawyers, the businessmen the businessmen, the artists the artists. Former prostitutes would seem to be a good group of people to try and understand prostitutes when it comes to that sort of work, and farmers to reach farmers. Housewives for housewives, chess players for chess players. They're much more likely to understand the position that people are in and the sort of issues that they're likely to have. Of course, you can do cross-cultural evangelism, but it's harder work. And what one's trying to do there is when you win them, you leave them to get on with it. But it's not easily engaged. You've got to learn another culture, another language, another set of beliefs and behaviour to do that task. And some of us are better at crossing cultural bridges than others, and it's always hard work, whatever. Because it raises the question, apologetics is one of the things that puts people off it, that it makes it hard work. Well, it only makes it hard work if you do try and cross the cultures. If you're, as a GP, the obvious people for me to talk to are GPs. I don't understand about GPs. I know their training. I know the sort of things that they're doing day by day. It shouldn't be beyond my wit to reach them, although I might have a lot more difficulty engaging with lawyers. They do look at the world differently. And so forth. So if we stay within our own group, and to the level of that group, and if you are a PhD student, you doing a PhD in cosmology, you'll be quite relaxed doing that. But I would find that much more difficult. Evangelism vicars, I'm sure they should. There's plenty of work there. But I mean, that's an interesting sort of group, because, I mean, they are a very particular subgroup. And you know all about their suspicions of evangelical, that dreadful group who caused so much trouble in the church. And they want to introduce lay presidency and all the sort of hang-ups they have and anxieties they carry. A clergyman is probably very much better at trying to cross those bridges. I think that's sort of basically it. I mean, it follows from this that to be an expert at evangelism requires continuous working at the task. It's a cop-out to think that we don't need to address people's doubts and difficulties. And if someone objects, has a major objection to the faith, I've heard people sort of say, well, why does the church tolerate slavery or so forth? You can't just duck an issue like that and ignore it. You know, if somebody's really troubled by that, then I don't know anything about it, so I've got to go and, I can remember hearing an evangelist doing exactly that. He was quizzed about slavery. He told me afterwards, I never given my thought to this matter. They'd be jolly sure he did after that. He went home and got the books out. And so the next, he wasn't going to be caught out like that again. So I conclude five then fundamental requirements for authentic evangelism. The first has to be prayer. This concern to persuade. It's the whole tone here. We're told they're persuaded. We're not told they were converted. That's not the language that Luke uses. God alone converts, but that he was trying, that they were constantly trying to persuade. It's in that context the Spirit of Truth converts, and that's where our prayers must be directed. That this isn't just a discussion or a persuasive discussion, but it's a conversion discussion that results in somebody being born again into a new life and the gift of faith. So prayer is essential. But preparation is essential. This is lifelong learning, isn't it? You don't sort of go on a course and apologetically think I've done that. I mean, you're constantly having to wrestle with these things. And then you've got to have a presence with these people. There's got to be some grounds where you get alongside them. And this is, the point you were making about the difficulties of getting alongside those who are not fringe people. It's a hard slog. I've got a partner we've been in partnership together for 25 years, and we know him well. He's atheist, deeply atheistic, and we've occasionally talked about the gospel, and he knows full well where I'm at, and we've retained a good friendship, but he's a member of the local humanist group, but he invited me some little while ago for a meeting that took place just about 4 weeks ago. He said, would you like to speak to my humanist group? Well, that's an extraordinary thing to him to ask. I said, what do you think I might say to them? He said, well, you could say, what have the Christians ever done for us? I said, yeah, you're on for that. I'll do that. So, it was something to do with our friendship, something to do with the fact that he was obviously confident I wouldn't disgrace him. He obviously thought I could do it in a way that would be interesting, because he'd had that group of humanist friends for a very long time too. He wasn't going to risk them on me. He thought it would be a fun evening. Well, it took 25 years to get to get that sort of opening, but it was one of the best opportunities I've ever had in evangelism. Just wonderful. They advertised it in the public library. Dr. May will address a skeptical audience. And a girl at church saw this, and she knew a friend who was a humanist, so she invited a humanist friend to come to the humanist meeting. She enjoyed it so much afterwards, she asked for a program card afterwards so she could come each week. But one of them came up and said, it's the best evening we've ever had. And I had 2.5 hours with them. I spoke for about half an hour on. I looked at law and democracy and freedom and justice and the education and healthcare and moral values. And I spoke for about half an hour. And then they had about 20 minutes of clarification about what I'd said. And then we had coffee break for 15 minutes, and they came back, and the meeting started at 7 and it finished at 9:30. And all the time, there were three hands up. Every time, as soon as we finished, I'm saying three more hands would go up, and the chairman would say, no, you've asked two questions already. You've only asked one. It's your... it was tremendous fun. But, those opportunities are hard to come by, and you've got to somehow have that presence with the people that you're going to do if you're going to be actually asked to do it. The Paul was so quickly invited to the Areopagus says something about the sheer depth of his analysis of their culture, what was they were hearing in the marketplace. They were, bowled over by it. And hold on, we've got to hear this man. And of course, that's had to do with his whole education and grounding in Greek culture. It isn't something that you could just walk in and do. So prayer, preparation, presence, proclamation. We've got to make the gospel clear, but we've also got to persuade people that it's true. And if you take out any of those things, I think you've blown it. If you go into it without praying, you go into it without preparing, you expect to do it without any presence with people, you expect to do it without actually telling them what the gospel is, or you do all those other things but don't actually try and persuade them that it's true. Seems to me it's a far cry from what they're trying to do in the New Testament. I think that's, yeah. Sorry.
I've been out of prison for a while, and then like the Alpha Course was just starting.
Right.
So, and then I understand that the Alpha Course has been very successful in a number of places, and there are also other various, you know, kind of similar copycat type of courses, I think.
Yeah.
How does it engage with people's serious questions and doubts? Is there this aspect persuasion?
Well, to my mind, not nearly enough. I mean, there are some very attractive features of the Alpha Course. I think the whole idea of doing it over supper parties is entirely sensible. You know, people relax there and they've got the possibility of asking spontaneous, natural questions. But it seems to me that nearly all the major issues are all packed into the first evening. And if you haven't sort of covered, you know, the existence of God, the incarnation of Christ, the resurrection, the coming judgment, the nature of faith, and heaven knows what else is done in that first session, you've got about 20 minutes or so to talk about that. From then on, you're ushered on to the very churchy things. And then you have a whole session on demons and healing and things that I think are very unwise and are very much Christian agenda things and not really engaging with there. So I don't think it does give them the opportunity to really dig in and find out where they're at. So, yeah.
I think one thing is it's just opened up where we're at, which a potentially exciting development is the restaurant just down the road. We've had follow-up meetings there after evangelistic guest services, so someone's come and heard a written presentation of the gospel, and we've gone over there to pick up questions and things. And the guy in the restaurant's really open for us to walk into something on the resurrection of Easter. And just maybe the idea of doing something like this, where you take an area like pluralism and talk about it, discuss it, get all your kind of skeptical guys in there, and just talk about it. Just try and clear the way of doing it in that context. So I just think courses like the Christianity at School explained, they didn't deal with it. I don't think they really clear the ground.
No.
It's just what I was wanting to just to explore a discussion, because I mean we run from our church, but in a nearby Catholic sometimes a Christianity at School course, which we call Arena. And what it does have, which is good, is a discussion element, and it very much does say no holds barred on the question. So in the talk about X, and then the facilitator for the life and death and resurrection of Jesus, but they can ask anything they like. But I'd just be interested to know whether you've any experience of something along the lines of evangelism. You could have a mini series or occasional pieces which say, look, we're just going to have an open session on these objections to it. Not necessarily, as you say, in church,
but
elsewhere.
Hmm. But I think some of the stuff that Richard Cunningham has done has been very creative here, because he's taken things that are in the public interest. I mean, the one he mentioned today was the Irish situation, but I think he's done a whole range of things like that where they're put up in a very attractive way, where he perhaps brought in a celebrity speaker or whatever, and people have felt, yeah, that really is an interesting subject. I really would like to hear this person on it. And, you know, there are ways of getting them in. I think it depends a bit on how you're setting it up. You know, I think if you're putting in the vicar will then talk to you about why Christianity is unique, it might not seem quite as interesting as if you've got Vijay Menon or a converted Hindu who's sort of, you know, well, I'm no longer a Hindu. So I'm sure there are ways of setting these things up. But, of course, you've got to have confidence in the event, haven't you, to if people are going to back it. And you've got, I think, one of the things Richard has managed to do and is crucial to the success of series that he's been doing in Oxford is that it has one session is built on the next. It's gained credibility. And everyone knows this is going to be an interesting evening. They always are. They're always the ones I've been to are. Well, he stopped now because he's working with UCCF, but I mean, he was responsible for organising it at St Andrew's Church. But so it was very much a church thing. But I mean, there was a Sunday evening in Oxford, and the church was packed out. And he would do it, I don't know, once every couple of months or something like that. And he'd bring in Ryan Atkins or I forget the different people that he. But people, they're either going to ring bells with the speaker or the subject matter. I'm thinking, yeah, that's worth actually, that's even more interesting than Antiques Roadshow, you know, so, which is one of the most popular television programs in England.
In many ways, you want your local church to be driving it.
Sorry, you want your
local church leaders to drive it.
Yes.
If at the moment we're inactive and we're not going out and doing this, then I guess that the danger of always importing people in is that we're not modelling it. So I'm a curator, so if I'm not modelling it,
yeah.
Then it's not necessarily giving confidence to people.
Yeah.
And it just means we're modelling them in our own churches, our own context, and getting on to doing it.
If you only have Bill Craig coming in, no one can repeat, you know, what he can do, and it's brilliant what he does. But you know, in terms of apologetics, for me to hear that doesn't help. It doesn't really help me to go and I can't use I can't repeat his material because it's just so far way up there.
Well,
interesting to explore that question because see, I think the problem is it depends on the audience. I mean, I'm not a scientist, but I can understand 9/10 of you know I can understand a substantial portion of the issues in science today. I can work a little bit at understanding science that has been explained to me by scientists. Now, I may not have credibility in the eyes of a scientist, but at least in the eyes of a non-scientist, I feel pretty confident when I can demonstrate my full heart about that.
Yes.
Probably harder than that.
And then the average opportunity, you're only going to put in the central issues. So I felt quite confident in discussing this, knowing, I mean, I was asked to preach on Genesis chapter 1, so it was obvious to get in something there about it. And people were amazed. They were on the edge of their seats. Eventually the Sunday school all came and disrupted things. The thing had to be sort of shut down early. They'd all been sent into the church. So, you know, people were furious because they were really engaged with this. We're talking about Stephen Hawking's and the, the theory of everything sort of thing. And then I did this humanist thing and got a direct question about belief on a creator God, and so I was able to talk about the steady state thing and something out of nothing and the options there and the red light thing.
There's kind of levels. You know, it's really encouraging to faith, my faith, to hear Bill Craig, the good reasons I can, you know, like you understand most of what's going on when he's explaining it. But if a scientist, atheist scientist, comes up and says, what about the
Well, then you say, yeah, well, that's outside my field, really. But
yeah.
I think what's important is what you say about, and what I felt in the times I've used this stuff recently, is that I must make sure that what I'm saying is true. So I've worked hard to make sure that the paragraph that I've put in is accurate, so that if there's a cosmologist there, he'll say, yep, that's right, that's what the redshift is, and that it is a Doppler effect, and the background radiation, that's what it does mean, and that is the end issue, that, you know, created out of nothing. So if he comes back with technical questions, I can say, well, you know, I haven't really studied the oscillating view, and don't ask me about string theory, but you know, I did know enough about it to know that these theories keep coming and going because the underlying issue is so bleak and stark. And none of these others are going to have currently won the day. They're just passing interest. I think we've probably run out of time, have we? Yeah.
Yeah.
Right.
In terms of the Carl Cho.
You could email me for it. I could send you. I've got it on my screen at home. Yeah. Yeah. May@ukgateway.net. I could. May@ukgateway.net. Yeah. I've got it on my screen, so I just a matter of pressing the button and sending it back to you. Yeah. But I thought it was a great paper. Yeah. All right. Shall we? Well, thank you for spending time on a hot afternoon and your last opportunity to do any shopping. Shall we just have a prayer together before we go? Father, we are concerned to know how to help the churches to engage with a disbelieving and ignorant world who, given half a chance, would have an awful lot of questions to ask. And we confess that we're part of a church that flees from the questions and doesn't bother to do the homework, and then when we do get the opportunity, we don't quite know how to handle it, or we mishandle it and we overshoot, and we seem to have very much lost touch with this whole concept of dialogue as being a normative way of sharing the faith. So we pray, Father, that you would go on teaching us what we should be doing and how we should do it, and inspire us with ideas and practical helps that we might be all the more effective in proclaiming the gospel in the years that lie ahead. For your name's sake, amen. Right, well, thank you very much for turning up. I didn't think anyone would turn up on an afternoon like this. And it's also rather basic material, but I should have been better placed at the beginning of the week rather than at the end. But anyway.
And it's more monologues and Paul dialoguing. How preaching, proper preaching, relates to that, because it's more of a monologue, isn't it? And I know you can monologue in conversation, and you can say, well, you can set up hypotheses, we may say this, but it says here, we can do that, but it's not quite the same as conversing. No,
but you see, that's why I take encouragement from Acts 17, that it was a monologue, but it was effectively a dialogue. He was at every point in what he said, he was addressing where they were at.
Well, I think that is doubly valuable
because it makes you vulnerable. You know, we stand there sort of protected. But actually say, you know, I'm going to take away, well, these humanists, you know, I said, okay, you can ask any question. I don't even need to be able to answer all the questions. I can say, I'm sorry, I haven't a clue, mate. I don't know. Give us another question that I can answer. You know, I don't think you lose any points on that, really. I mean, if they're asking a question about the Trinity and I say, I don't know, that's a bit odd. You know, I should be able to make some sort of defence of that. And they did ask about the Trinity, but they didn't want a long answer. I said, well, look, this is the way, you know, Paul never described theology of the Trinity. It was an experiential thing about God revealed himself to them. So a few sentences along those sort of lines and we're on to suffering or whatever. But, you know... Well, it wasn't, you see, and they were all predictable and they just loved it. And one of the sadnesses, the Christian girl who brought her humanist friend brought her friend along. So there were two of them brought along by this one Christian girl. One of them said at the end of it, said, do you go to the same church he does? And she said, yes, I do. He said, can I come? And she said, yes, you can. But then when she thinks about it, there's nothing in church that she's felt she's wanted to bring them to. It's just, you know, she just, what a...
The humanist society has better evangelistic meetings.
Well, quite. Quite. and she thinks there might be an event in July that she could risk bringing her friend to, but she just doesn't feel she can bring her to a church service, which I think is heaps sad, really.
It's so sad when people can't bring you to a Sunday service.
Because then, of course, you've...
It's so weird.
Yeah. And you know, you're talking about setting up this thing. Well, at least, you know, if you've got something there, then people will be encouraged to sort of work at it. But if there's nothing there, then forget it. You know, we don't do evangelism in our church. It's off.
We should train people. We should train our kids as well.
Yeah.
We should train our children as they're getting older to be thinking in terms of the culture's mindset.
Yeah.
Seeing that as part of their evangelism.
Yeah.
We should train them, from an early age.
Yeah, well, Richard Cunningham's obviously having fun with his kids at school, engaging with the questions they've got and going along and speaking at their group. And, yes, I've had fun with my kids along that line.
Thank you.
Thank you very much.